From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump on Sunday fired off a series of tweets in response to reports of a deadly gas attack on Douma in the eastern Ghouta province of Syria. He wrote, quote, "President Putin, Russia, and Iran are responsible for backing animal Assad," referring to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. He added, "big price to pay." Trump, his national security advisors, and Defense Department officials are considering what that price will be and announced at a cabinet meeting on Monday that a decision would be forthcoming in 24 to 48 hours. Because Douma is surrounded by Syrian government forces, so far all reports of the gas attack, including photos and videos, have originated from rescue workers and Syrian activists on the ground. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons says it's investigating the veracity of the attack. Meanwhile, the Syrian government has just accused Israel of bombing one of its airfields only one day after reports of the gas attack. France has said it is on board with any coordinated international action against Syria. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches sociology at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and he is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for our program. Welcome back to the show, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So the veracity of the attack, the fact that it actually happened, is going to be called into question because on that will hinge any justification that Donald Trump and the U.S. government make to remain in Syria, to escalate the war in Syria. What do you make of the reports that have come out so far? It's somewhat similar to some reports that came out last year of a gas attack.
Well, you know, again, I see no reason to disbelieve any of these reports. Everything that's happened before, allegations have been borne out by international investigations. The OPCW, among others, investigated the Khan Sheikh Hun attack last year, and I don't see any reason not to believe that, in fact, it was Syrian regime forces involved in chemical attacks. There are stories that, you know, first of all, of course, some Syria did disarm of some chemical weapons after the very serious attacks in Ghouta in 2013, which killed a considerably larger number of people and got the United States to push a chemical weapons deal with Syria. But there are stories that it has been engaged in trade for components for chemical weapons with, among other states, North Korea. Again, I don't see very much reason to doubt these attacks. Every time it happens that rebels or rebel supporters or rebel strongholds get attacked by chemical weapons, somebody tries to claim that the rebels are always attacking themselves with chemical weapons. But that's a kind of, you know, extreme claim that would require some evidence to back it up. And the most that people ever do is try to cast doubt on the accumulating weight of evidence on the other side. So yeah, I mean, we'll see what the OPCW says, but my guess is that they will find that in fact there were chemicals used. It may not be sarin, it may just be chlorine that was used, but that still is a violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, the Geneva Conventions, and the laws of war.
So a big part of the very likely massive debate that will happen on the left, it will be whether or not this attack was real, because they fear the U.S. is going to use this as a reason to continue remaining in Syria. In fact, the New York Times had an article about how Trump was basically on the verge of exiting Syria when the reports of this attack pulled him back in. For our TV audience, the screen grab is up. As Trump seeks way out of Syria, new attack pulls him back in. All of that, of course, nicely fits the narrative that the report of the gas attack is the a reason why Trump will use this to remain in Syria. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, large parts of the left are constructing a bizarre narrative in which Donald Trump is some kind of latter-day George McGovern who wants to give peace a chance, who wants to bring America home, but the evil deep state in the national security complex is relentlessly pushing, using everything it can, including the mainstream media, to suck him into exactly what? Nobody can say. There is absolutely no chance that the United States is going to engage in a military campaign in Syria like the occupation of Iraq. That is simply not on the table. So any reasonable analyst has got to conclude that whatever the United States is going to do is not going to fundamentally alter the balance of power in Syria right now, which is with the Assad regime and its legions of foreign supporters, including Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, the Iraqi government through various Iraqi Shiite militias, etc. That anything the United States is contemplating is not whether it is the Trump or the supposed elements of the deep state is not going to alter that balance. So it's really not clear what their narrative is. It has about as much sort of depth and analytical power to it as the various 9/11 conspiracy narratives at this point.
Let's watch the video of what Donald Trump said on Monday morning at a cabinet meeting. This was a day after he fired off a series of tweets about action on Syria. Apparently, there are discussions happening as you and I speak, Rahul, about what the U.S. government response would be. This is what Trump said on Monday.
Thank you very much. I'd like to begin by condemning the heinous attack on innocent Syrians with banned chemical weapons. It was an atrocious attack. It was horrible. You don't see things like that as bad as the news is around the world. You just don't see those images. We are studying that situation extremely closely. We are meeting with our military and everybody else, and we'll be making some major decisions over the next 24 to 48 hours. We are very concerned when a thing like that can happen. This is about humanity. We're talking about humanity. And it can't be allowed to happen. So we'll be looking at that barbaric act and studying what's going on. We're trying to get people in there. As you know, it's been surrounded, so it's very hard to get people in because not only has it been hit, it's been surrounded. And if they're innocent, why aren't they allowing people to go in and prove? Because, as you know, they're claiming they didn't make the attack. So if it's Russia, if it's Syria, if it's Iran, if it's all of them together, we'll figure it out. And we'll know the answers quite soon. So we're looking at that very, very strongly and very seriously.
And that's President Donald Trump on Monday at a cabinet meeting with his new national security advisor, John Bolton, seated right behind him, condemning the Syrian government, reports of the Syrian government attacking eastern Ghouta province and the town of Douma with a chemical weapon. He used the words heinous, atrocious, horrible, and said this is about humanity. Rahul, it's of course rich for someone like Donald Trump to talk about humanity. But earlier you said that there's absolutely no chance that there would be a U.S. Operation in Syria, the likes of which we saw in Iraq. But we now have John Bolton speaking into the ear of a very dangerous and easily influenced president. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's hard to know what to make of that. I think that John Bolton is a pretty smart guy, and he has undoubtedly figured out that the way to lead Trump by the nose is not to lecture him the way that McMaster did. And he is a potentially really dangerous wild card. And there are other things that seem to be in the contemplation that would make an occupation of Syria look like a cakewalk, including talks about some kind of hot war with North Korea. So all of that given, there is still as yet no sign that the United States isn't going to engage in anything more than relatively small-scale operations. I don't want to exaggerate. There are about 2,000 U.S. forces in Syria right now, and the United States has definitely altered the balance of forces in the fight against ISIS. It's just that, relatively speaking, in terms of the total amount of military engagement in Syria, the entire ISIS fight is a pretty minor component of it, while, you know, obviously important for the people who are directly affected. So I don't want to underemphasize the rise in U.S. engagement since Obama's almost complete disengagement. And of course, most of that rise did occur in the Obama administration. But there's no way to find within any part of the national security establishment any support for an occupation, for the kind of thing that would be required to dismantle the Assad regime and keep control. And there is now ample evidence of what happens in these countries once you destroy the state, destroy the basic organs for the functioning of society, and then leave things up to whatever group of people with enough guns and enough fanaticism can take over. So I don't think that there is very much chance of the United States doing much more than the kind of muddling through it's done. I mean, a year ago after Khan Sheikhoun, Trump authorized a few random airstrikes against Syrian bases. I'm sure we can expect something like that again after all of this tough talk. But this kind of bluster is not in any way, a precursor of a coherent policy. And I'd remind you, even under Bush, they did bizarre rhetorical things, like they made a big point of saying that what was going on in Darfur was a genocide, which legally would have obligated the United States to intervene. And everybody was in a panic about the U.S. intervening in the middle of Africa in a major way, which it has never done, which it will never do, because it doesn't want to take the kind of risk that would be involved. And that fizzled out. There's a lot of rhetorical overkill that doesn't mean that there's going to be commitment to a major sustained military engagement.
Right. I mean, Trump keeps creating conditions for himself that he can't meet, but I don't think that stops him. For example, he said if President Obama had crossed his stated red line in the sand, the Syrian disaster would have ended long ago. Essentially, what he's, if one were to take him at his word, one might ask him maybe a month from now, well, what happened to this gas attack in Douma, and why didn't you do something about that if you blamed your predecessor for not doing anything? So you're suggesting that Trump is all talk and that this will not lead into a full-scale U.S. intervention, which you and I would likely, would agree would do nothing to improve the situation in Syria anyway.
Well, it's very hard to imagine that it would. The only thing I think that the United States could potentially do that would help, and I mean, this is in the context where I guess a lot of proponents of the whole Syrian uprising would not be happy with the statement, but I think that the war is over except for a series of painful holding actions and lots more people being killed. So in the context of trying to wind the war down in such a way that Assad and his allies don't take massive reprisals, which surely they are going to do, I can imagine a role for the United States in trying to negotiate that. Even that kind of negotiation has to have some kind of hint of force or it's not going to work. But, the sad thing is not that the United States is incapable of doing a genuinely humanitarian intervention. It's when it becomes a choice of doing a genuinely humanitarian intervention, that's when there is no longer any political will in the United States to do it.
Right.
I mean, that's a consistent pattern. That's what happened in Rwanda in 94. There's no way to argue that U.S. Response, or at least U.S. stopping its deliberate undercutting of the U.N. peacekeeping force, might not have helped to head off at least part of the genocide. But at that point, the Clinton administration resolutely made sure not to do anything to help.
Well, on that issue, there was a piece by Simon Jenkins in The Guardian about the Syria attack. I don't know if you saw it, but it had a provocative title, "Only Assad's Victory Will End Syria's Civil War. The West Can Do Nothing." The byline said, the subtitle said, "The chemical attack in Douma was horrific, but Western military intervention would only prolong Syria's suffering." I'm convinced that Simon Jenkins is a fan of Assad, but what do you make of this suggestion on its face?
Well, you know, I think that this is the kind of thing that that really is going to enrage people. But first of all, the United States has not proven itself able to act in such a way that over the long term it really helps anybody in these interventions. Secondly, the United States no longer has the theoretical capacity to engage in overwhelming force to defeat the Assad regime, because he has a very powerful ally. So that's why negotiations are necessary, but negotiations aren't going to achieve anything if the United States has made it so clear that it is not committed to actually doing anything in Syria. And that is the actual truth. Despite the ongoing left narrative about how this is part of the U.S. imperialist plot, the truth is that U.S. imperialism in the region is absolutely in tatters, and they are flailing to figure out what they can do, and most of the time they're doing very little.
What is I want to go back to what you said earlier about the rebels on the ground. What exactly has the situation in Douma been in terms of it being viewed as one of the last strongholds internally within the sort of internal part of Syria of the rebel groups? And, you know, this is a very vague term these days, rebel groups. It's not clear on the ground who's left and what their allegiances are.
It's absolutely not clear. I mean, overall, I suppose that this new formation, Tahrir al-Sham, is one of the most important fighting groups. But who the various fighters are, what kind of allegiances they have, how those allegiances shift, none of it's very clear. There are competing claims. Again, I generally, when there's data, I generally tend to trust the claims of people who support the Syrian resistance rather than people who support the Syrian regime. But, you know, that said, that it's very hard to disentangle them. But outside of Idlib and Eastern Ghouta, I mean, the rebellion is mostly over. And right now, of course, you've got in the last few weeks estimates of at least 1,600 people killed in the assault and 10,000 or more displaced, many of them fleeing as refugees to Idlib and other places. So, you know, you're seeing destruction of that region. Everyone knows, by the way, that once the war is over, nobody is going to pick up the tab to reconstruct Syria. Mm-hmm. Russia's not going to do it. That's for sure. So every bit of prolongation of this is going to cause massive suffering for decades and generations to come.
What about reports of going back to how the international community may or may not respond to the gas attack in Douma? What about reports that Israel has bombed an airfield in Syria? Syria is accusing Israel of doing so. It's not yet clear if that's exactly what happened, but it came a day after reports of the gas attack.
Well, I mean, Israel is obviously serving its own purposes. It's not really about the gas attack for Israel. It's about, so once Russia intervened in a major way in the conflict, Israel had to figure out how to deal with that. So there was a period where Israel was not doing any direct interventions. They've obviously reached some kind of modus vivendi with Russia, and they're now serving their own interests, which are primarily about making sure that neither Hezbollah nor Iran can establish a major stable foothold in Syria with the potential to bring in large amounts of high military technology stuff that could be used to attack Israel. So that's what they're doing. They're doing their best to make sure that doesn't happen. So there are, again, variously reported, but somewhere in the neighborhood of a couple of thousand Iranian Revolutionary Guards acting as so-called military advisors, trainers, etc., in Syria. The Israelis claim that the Iranians are effectively in command of a force of maybe 60,000 different militiamen, even though that is probably not an accurate interpretation of what's going on. They play a major role in the whole conflict, way beyond the actual number of people that are in there from Iran because of their role in coordinating with various militias, including Iraqi Shia militias. And they're obviously, they've been there for a while, and they are setting up for longer-term militarized presence, and that is the kind of thing that has Israel utterly paranoid at this point.
Finally, Rahul, I'm wondering whether you have a sense of the pressures that Trump is facing, both from his own party and even from liberals to act in Syria. He has essentially given the green light to the military in places like Afghanistan, but on Syria, as you've suggested, he's more talk than action. And it's the sort of thing that you get from liberals and the Democratic Party that humanitarian intervention is a big reason why the U.S. military should act in such cases. So I'm wondering if you're seeing any sort of Democratic or bipartisan push in Congress to urge Trump to jump into a full-scale military intervention in Syria, whether or not that will actually have any long-term consequences.
I'll tell you what. So basically, you know, at first cut, I don't think anybody cares. All right. I do. Maybe there's an exception. You know,
you don't think anyone cares about Syria?
Instagram access. Yeah, maybe they care in the sense that they want to recapture some notion from their glory days of an American military that can throw its weight around everywhere in the world, and it's easy enough to cloak it in humanitarian ideas. On the progressive left in Congress, you get people like Mark Pocan or Ro Khanna or others who are engaging in some level of public activism against U.S. support for the Saudis in Yemen. And this is so even though I don't think that they have really calculated the consequences of the significant divergence between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and the fact that Saudi Arabia is no longer going to essentially let itself be guided by U.S. dictates in the region. And so the United States, again, is sort of losing out there and doesn't know what it's doing. So there's a little bit of genuine moralism, but mostly I think it's just it's a rhetorical hammer. Liberals would like to show that Trump is actually an interventionist and he's anti-humanitarian and this and that. And some Republicans who hate Trump would like to say that he's not standing up for American ideals. But I think that there will be very little in terms of consequences to pay. One exception, maybe. I mean, there's certainly the possibility that the heating up of the Mueller investigation has something to do with Trump's sudden ejaculations against Putin, something that he has not done very much of so far. But in general, I don't see any significant pressure from Congress on any of these points, certainly not for humanitarian intervention in Syria.
Well, Rahul, thanks as always for putting these stories into context. We appreciate your analysis. Talk to you next time.
All right.
Rahul Mahajan is the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches sociology at University of Wisconsin, River Falls. He is our U.S. foreign policy and empire correspondent. We've been discussing reports of a gas attack in Duma and Trump's potential response to it. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.